Tristan Hughes is my guest this week. Tristan is an Anglican vicar in the church in Wales and a tutor in applied theology based in Cardiff. We talk about growing up in North Wales, doing all of his schooling through the medium of Welsh, the advantages of having a multilingual education, the evolution of school education and the 11 plus. Tristan talks about how, as a child, he was obsessed with football stickers and the search for the elusive missing sticker, how he would listen to classical music, and then about how he made the evolution to pop music and why a school friend was teased for being a Spandau Ballet fan. We talk about how this is all bound up in questions of identity. We learn why Tristan was obsessed with the Jam and music that carried a message, and how his children know all the words, this is so impressive, of Gilbert O'Sullivan's Nothing Rhymed. We find out how it was love that resulted in Tristan remaining in North Wales when he went to university. We learn about his PhD on the Roman Catholic Church in Wales. He talks about the journey he was on, which resulted in him leaving higher education, and why his calling took him to ordination. And he talks about his drive to connect with people through his subsequent faith-based publication. Tristan reveals how from a young age he has given thought to what his legacy is, and he talks about the importance of awareness. We discuss the nature of being an academic and what happens when one element, for example research, is put on a pedestal above another, such as teaching. We learn that Tristan's memories are predominantly positive. He explains why he doesn't tend to revisit the more painful ones. We discuss why it is important to use nostalgia to inspire the present. We discuss the question of what makes something great, why the education policy of any country should be the number one priority, and the importance of teaching about climate change. And we also then discuss whether the journey is as important as the destination. Then in the final part of the interview, we talk about extracurricular interests. Tristan draws on his own experience of living and dealing with pain. We find out what Tristan's younger self wanted to be, how our dreams develop quickly, the importance of knowing our limitations, the importance of maintaining friendships, and the value of Facebook in this regard. And then at the very end of the interview, Tristan talks about why he is such a hopeful person. So what an absolute privilege this week to catch up with Reverend Dr. Tristan Owen Hughes for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is such a pleasure to be in Cardiff and to reconnect with, I should say, Reverend Tristan, Reverend Doctor.
Reverend Doctor, you can say that.
Tristan Owen Hughes, and of course we worked together in Carmarthen, 15, 20 years ago.
I know, it's been a long, long time. I've missed you, Chris.
Well, before we started recording, we had a bit of a catch-up, so I think...
It wasn't a bit of a catch-up, we've been chatting for the past hour and a half, Chris. It's been great.
Know my life. In the last sort of, in 1 hour. So now it's your turn to take centre stage. But tell me a bit, interesting, because obviously we knew each other in Carmarthen, mm-hmm. but I know you're from North Wales, but tell me a little bit about your background, where and when you were born.
Okay, so I was actually born when we were living on the side of Snowdon. So my dad was the vicar of Snowdon, basically. So I was born in Bangor, and then we moved from there quite early, a little place called Deiniolen. We moved from there to Llandudno, which is far more famous, a sort of holiday town on the coast in North Wales. And then we moved to another village or town called Penmaen Mawr, which again is next to Conwy, which has a big castle. It's quite a famous castle, Conwy Castle. Penmaen Mawr is particularly famous for lots of different things. But in the 19th century, it was a great holiday destination for all the prime ministers. There's a statue of William Gladstone there. And Dylan Thomas talks about Penmaen Mawr in Undermilk Wood. He refers to Penmaen Mawr as the majestic mountain. So it's quite a famous place.
No, and the Gladstone connection as well, because near Chester, just over the border though, you've got the Gladstone Library in Harden.
In Harden,
and
that's right.
And they've got a huge theology and film, which of course is an
area. Of course, they're really big on film, aren't they? And
in the Gladstone Library. So you've got people who go there for religion and film literature, and people who want to research about Gladstone. I'm not sure how many people necessarily go for both, but
you never know.
So you did all that, and you went to school, I'm guessing, as well in North Wales.
I did. I did all my schooling through the medium of Welsh up to the age of 16. So all my subjects were taught through the medium of Welsh. So that was just in Llandudno, basically, Pembermawr Primary School in Llandudno, a place called Craithin, for my secondary school. And then in my sixth form, I moved to Colwyn Bay to do my sixth form A-levels through the medium of English in a school called Rydal.
How did you find that transition? Because I've got some family members who were also taught through medium of Welsh, but their parents can only speak English. Right. So there's that disconnect in what they're allowed to speak at school, which and it's often rigorously enforced, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You have to speak Welsh in school, indeed. Yeah, you really do. And it's and that's a good thing, really. When you're very young, you resent it a bit that you're being forced to speak Welsh, when the reality is, once you're out of school, even with those friends that you're hanging around with, you quite often just revert to English because that's what's on television and that's what you see in the films and so on. But as you grow older, you start to think, it's a really good thing.
And the thing I found as well with Welsh, because obviously I live in Canterbury, but so often I'll be teaching a student, or I might meet a colleague who's from South or North Wales. And what I find then is that a lot of the Welsh comes back to me, but also I think how wonderfully distinctive, because French or German are sort of languages that a lot of the people I work with are indeed from France and Germany. But Welsh, there is something very niche and very distinctive, and I'm so proud of being Welsh, and I only realised how proud I was because I always felt a bit of a fraud in Wales because I don't sound very Welsh. People think, you're not one of us. Moved to Canterbury and suddenly I feel this real, romantic sort of...
So you're wearing your Welsh rugby top all the time, are you,
Chris? On Sir David's Day, I'll have a daffodil.
Massive elite colour-signing chest, Well, that's very true. And I lived in Oxford for a few years and I had the same thing. It was then I really started to feel fully Welsh because even my accent isn't what people expect, especially not for a fluent Welsh speaker as I am. And it was so important to me with my own children that they had that opportunity to, and of course, as you know, my wife's German, so certainly my youngest child is completely trilingual, so he speaks German, English and Welsh and jumps between the both, and I think it's just a great blessing to be able to have that. And so I really appreciate having both English and Welsh, and I wish I could speak German and French a bit better as well, but I struggle.
So you've got a trilingual family we were talking about.
Exactly.
What about your parents? Because I know your dad is also a vicar.
Yeah, my dad's a vicar, retired now. He eventually became a hospital chaplain in a hospital in North East Wales, Ysbyty Glan Clwyd. And in a very famous, half-time in hospital chaplain, half-time in a famous church by the side of the A55, which is the big road that goes across the top of North Wales, and it's called the Marble Church. It's a spectacular church. People often presume it's a cathedral. It's so beautiful. So he was there. But my mum, she had quite an interesting story. She was actually brought up in Cardiff. I don't know if you know that. So she was brought up in Whitchurch. Born in Romford, lived in Dagenham for a few years, and when she was about 7 or 8, they moved to Cardiff. So she was brought up in Cardiff. Went to secondary modern school, and so did quite well in her O-levels, but because she'd been in secondary modern and not in a grammar school, they refused to let her do 3 A-levels. She could only do 2. But she obviously, as many people, was sort of pigeonholed very early as not academic or academic, and she was pigeonholed as not academic. But obviously she's got quite a rigorous academic mind and did superbly in her A-levels. But because of only having 2, she didn't go on to do a degree. She went on to train as an occupational therapist. And it wasn't until the 1990s, she then thought, well, maybe I can get a degree. And they allowed her to do a master's, and she did very, very well in a master's in gerontology, the study of elderly people.
It's really funny because I wonder if I'd had the 11 plus, because we've got the Kent test in where I live.
Of course,
and I wonder at the age of 11 how well I would have done. I don't think I would have. I think I peaked. I'm waiting for my peak, but
certainly
not the age of 11. And I was talking to my parents about this because neither of them passed the 11 plus, and they were telling me that at the time they said, but nobody in their class did. And it turned out that when they had the test, the syllabus, if you could even call it a syllabus back then, was not one that they had been taught. So the teacher had effectively said, "Oh, here's this exam." They didn't know how to answer the questions because they hadn't been taught it. But the teacher said, "Oh, I just confirm my idea that you're all useless." And I know, and this was like back in the 1950s. But and it's very different. So many of the students that we've taught, of course, have gone on to become school teachers. And you think how different. I think that the generation of students now going through you know, GCSEs, A-levels are in very good hands. Because we've taught them. But compared to generations
before. No, you're right. Yeah. You're right. There's far more opportunity now, and there's far more of a recognition that everyone has something to offer, something quite special. It's just finding what that is. And you find that with your own children and with your nephews. And my nephew, for example, did okay in school, but he now is studying in the Etihad Stadium, a degree in sort of football statistics and analysis, and is absolutely doing wonderfully. And he sort of every week they get a different famous manager in to talk to them. He's just gone over to the States to work in a football camp there, and he will get a degree through that. He just had to find his place, and I think that's what we need to do with all children, recognise there's something special in them. They're not all necessarily academic, but there'll be something that will fire them up.
Yeah, because I think we both did degrees, didn't we, in theology?
That's right, yeah.
And at the time, I think doing an inverted commas traditional degree was the right thing. But it's also interesting that I've had twin interests also with media. But it was right to do a traditional subject and then see where that can lead me, rather than do a media studies type degree, in which case I'd feel almost as though I was in competition with lots of other people with the same qualifications.
Right,
But in that sense, they're all going for media jobs. Whereas like we were saying about Wales and speaking Welsh, you have something more distinctive to offer.
That's true.
And you can, you know, I've got lots of students who, well, not lots, but some who might go on to do law conversion courses. So they've got a degree in religious studies, but then they do something very different. But they've got something very attractive to offer an employer. Like, well, I've had a very different route to any of your other potential employees who've all followed the same route. So I agree with you. Look, there's lots of ways that bring up the best in the person, and a degree like football statistics sounds brilliant if that's for you.
Yeah, well, one of my brothers actually trained to be a gamekeeper, believe it or not. You know, very different from the rest of us who are all in education in some ways. He trained to be a gamekeeper. It's through that and through meeting people through gamekeeping, which we always have very interesting discussions because I'm a vegetarian, as you probably remember. So you've probably forgotten that, have you, Chris? Yeah. So we have interesting discussions about that, as you can probably imagine. But it's through that he then trained to be a plumber, and he now works in North Wales as a plumber. That's his thing, and he's obviously found his skill, and it's just wonderful to see him thrive in doing that now.
Yeah. What about things you remember doing as a child? I'm assuming obviously in North Wales, but in terms of things that you remember doing, particularly your earliest memories?
Earliest memories, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Well, is it if I think of my interests as a child, I was obsessed, as funnily enough, my youngest son is now, with football stickers, Panini football stickers. So it was a big, big thing for me and my older brother. Well, we both thought that you know, you got somewhere in life if you could complete the sticker album, the Panini Football Division 1, it was at the time, of course, no Premier League then. And completing that, and we were very blessed, or lucky, I should say, in that way, in the sense my brother's best friend, his dad worked for Panini. So if we didn't have anything at the end, he'd bring home piles of them, and we could just sort through them and find the elusive missing sticker that we needed, which is great fun.
Yeah, and you're right, because I've never really followed football, but I used to get those stickers, and they used to come in like cornflake packets and all, you know, particularly around World Cups or FA Cups. And even to this day, I remember Glenn Hoddle, but also Emlyn Hughes, who was, I think, Wolverhampton Wanderers later years, because I associated him with being a bit of a, not clown, but on a question of sport, he always used to be the playful one.
Yeah.
And I remember once thinking, he wasn't really a player, was he? Because I only saw him in disguise as like a media, panellist.
Exactly, and I could never work out with Emlyn Hughes, because of course we share a surname. Yeah. And I couldn't work out why he played for England.
Yeah.
I was always confused. Surely he played for Wales if you're called Hughes. Yeah. So there was a lot of that. There was a lot of playing outside, because we were living very close to the mountains. The great thing about Pemamara, you've got a mountain directly behind you, and you've got the sea directly in front of you, so you can play on the beach or you can play on the mountains. There was a lot of games that we used to mess around. There was a game called Block 1-2-3, which some people might remember. They're just sort of like hide and seek type games. So we did a lot of that. I did a lot of sports, playing a lot of football. It wasn't structured like it is now. Now you take your kids to sports stuff. It was basically just getting a football and kicking it around on a field when I was younger. You know, I played a bit of cricket with my mates. Played golf, so there was a golf club in Pemamara, and got into golf relatively young, and won a few competitions and so on. So I enjoyed golf at the time. But then there was also film. There was always film and music. I always loved film and music, so they were always around when we were younger as well.
Yeah. Because one of the things I will be asking you later is whether you would ever have imagined when you were 5 or 15 what you are doing now. But you mentioned film and music because, of course, that was very integral to your research, your teaching, certainly back, back when I knew you. So what was it, sort of like chart-based music or contemporary music?
Well, music was quite interesting in our family because my mum, when she was younger, was a huge fan of Buddy Holly. And we knew that. But having said that, pop music of any sort was essentially, I wouldn't say banned from our house, but we just never listened to it. It just wasn't on at all. It wasn't seen as an important thing. But my mum in particular, and my dad as well, but my mum in particular loved classical music. So classical music was around us all the time. And so I got to know the classical music composers very quickly and still love listening to them. Don't often, I must admit, because what took me then when I was sort of, I suppose it was when I was 10 or 11, 12, watching Saturday Superstore, was a swap shop probably at the time, wasn't it? It was those sort of Saturday morning programmes that we were allowed to watch Saturday morning programmes. It was the first introduction to us of pop music. And it really made a huge impact on me. Yeah. And I almost became, by the time I was in my late teens, I was obsessed with pop music. I really was. So yeah, that was quite important in growing up.
I think you're right, because there were lots of those rituals. Checkers Plays Pop was the other one, of course. A bit of a spin-off of Keith Chequin on Saturday Superstore or Swap Shop. But there was something about Thursday nights with Top of the Pops, where I remember in the charts on a Sunday as well, but in the playground, you know, we'd all be talking about the artists that we'd seen, what they were wearing, and in terms of what it did about fashion, whether it's anything Bucks Fizz to Visage or Gary Numan, Duran Duran, and in a way that's kind of what bonded us. We were all bound together by this sense that we may have had different musical tastes, but we all witnessed it on the programme. You know, if you were a punk, Hazel O'Connor or Toya, you know, that there was an outlet, and for half an hour on a Thursday evening you might just get a look at the person who chimed with your own sort of predilection. So you obviously got that through Saturday Superstore.
Yeah, exactly. It was something about identity, wasn't there? Because I look back now and I feel it was a great shame, because some of those bands that were great, we just dismissed because, you know, when you're 10 or 11, that's a girl's band. Yeah. So a band like Duran Duran, which now I listen to and absolutely love, you know, at the time I would never have admitted I liked Duran Duran. That just wasn't. Whereas, you know, admitting you liked Status Quo was great amongst the lads. So that's what you did. You sort of, that's what you listened to.
Of course, go forward 13, 14 years, and of course Status Quo
exactly,
was suing radio and BBC to not play the music, but they were, you know, they were going down.
Yeah, so you're completely right. Yeah, and so there was... there was all that going on. I remember a friend of mine at the time was a big fan of Spandau Ballet, you know, and I don't think we stopped teasing him for 4 or 5 years in a row just because he was a Spandau Ballet fan. And now I listen to Spandau Ballet. It's brilliant. Yeah. I'm just, you know, saying it's a shame. You miss out at the time because it was all bound in identity and what your identity was. So I found that quite an interesting journey in sort of experiencing different pop music and rock. And, you know, later on it became very different, the kind of music I liked. But as a child, it was just the chart stuff.
But it's interesting, that whole generational thing as well, because my dad was also hugely into Buddy Holly, and he's got all of some of the old LPs.
Oh, really? Great.
I assume and hope he's still got them, along the gun as well. But you're right, so I had this sort of twin interest of late 50s music, early 60s, then a bit of a gap, because I'm now hugely into 70s stuff, but then the 80s was my generation, but my parents didn't quite share that taste.
Right.
So I was sort of aware that I loved their music and I love mine, but we didn't sort of, we saw eye to eye on like half of the stuff I was interested in. But to this day, you know, whenever I hear Pick of the Pops, or, you know, when they're doing a chart from the late 50s, early 60s, I always feel the need to sort of text my dad and say, you might want to listen because, you know, you bought half of these records. I know they're in your old cabinet.
Yeah, but I got very, very interested in the earlier eras. I mean, you know, because of course, by the time I was really, really into music, it was the sort of mid-80s. That was when I was sort of 13, 14, 15. And of course, even groups like The Jam were gone, and that was the older era. And I was a huge fan of The Jam. At the time, you know, Paul Weller had gone to form Style Council, but I just became obsessed with The Jam and obsessed with people like... Billy Bragg and people that had a message. I think I was interested that music conveyed a message to people, and I found that enthralling. And actually, even the music, occasionally my mum and dad, even when I was younger, there'd suddenly be a song. I don't know where they heard it because they didn't used to really listen to radio, but they'd hear a song that would chime with them. And so I remember singing Ebony and Ivory in the car.
Yeah.
You know, and that again is a song with a message. Mm. So whether my mum and dad sort of recognised that there was something about the power of popular culture that could convey a narrative, I think that certainly became important to me as the years went on.
Yeah. And just before we were recording, we were having a chat about what was number one when we were born. In my case, it was See My Baby Jive from Wizard, which, if I'm honest, it's not the best Wizard song, but it was number one in June 1973. And we were just talking about Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Gilbert O'Sullivan, yes. And I didn't really... I mean, I have to... Hands up. We had to look it up, yeah, didn't we? which mine was. But when I saw it as Gilbert O'Sullivan, I was astounded, yeah, because it's only about a year ago I really got into Gilbert O'Sullivan, and my children now know all the words to Nothing Rhymed and all these old Gilbert O'Sullivan hits. Yeah. And I got to know him through his latest album, which is only a year or two back, which is... so many of these artists seem to fade away and then come back and are given a new lease of life, like Johnny Cash was given and Glen Campbell was given and so on, and it seems to me that Gilbert O'Sullivan has done the same thing.
He has, and he just made me think, because I've got some old sort of early 90s tapes when Neil Diamond would come on, and there was a sense that he was seen to be a little bit sort of not entirely sort of the bee's knees anymore.
Exactly.
But he utterly came back, didn't he,
yeah,
in the late 2000s. And, you know, Radio 2 were really taking him seriously,
yeah,
whereas perhaps he would have been a bit more mocked in the early 90s.
Well, I remember Johnny Cash. And when I was younger, I got into country music in my late teens. You probably remember I'm a huge country music fan, can't you, Chris? So I got into country music in my late teens and used to love Johnny Cash's stuff. But he was always seen as an old-fashioned fool. And he even played in Butlins in, I think it's Minehead or somewhere like that, somewhere in the south. And then, of course, in the late 90s, suddenly came back with these albums when he recorded with the producer, I think it was Rick Rubin, the producer. And as now, you know, it's very cool to like, even from the late 90s onwards, liking Johnny Cash has suddenly been, and of course, then he passed away and it almost adds to the legend then. But it is interesting, isn't it, how these people seem to be seen as old-fashioned and go out. Even someone like Dire Straits. Dire Straits, you know, 5 years ago was seen as, you know, very... It was seen as very uncool to like Dire Straits. I get the impression, you know, talking to my son, who's now 18, they're getting, you know, they're getting the respect they deserve, really.
Yeah, Mark Knopfler's just turned 70, but you're right. There are some artists who kind of maybe at the time that they first came out, something didn't quite connect.
Yeah.
And maybe it's the particular of the market and sort of the people who were buying, you know, singles records. But some, particularly Van Morrison, who never had any big chart hit. But I would just assume that, like, when, you know, if I told you Late That I Love You, would have been a huge chart hit. No, never even charted.
Yeah.
Chris Rea is another one.
Yeah.
He's had some big hits, but quite a few of his, even Driving Home for Christmas, never really charted. And that's one of the sort of Christmas perennials.
Classics.
So I think sometimes there needs to be a bit of a space, and people just sort of say, you know, some artists are more sort of chart bound and others are sort of more, you know, they will last. Their staying power is going to be a bit more enduring.
Exactly, yeah.
And how did you end up then? Because obviously I knew you very much as an academic, but how did you end up sort of teaching in theology and religious studies?
So I actually went to my local university, which is Bangor University in North Wales, and part of that was because I was going out with a girl at the time who was living in Conway, and so it made sense to go local. I'd had a nice offer from Durham University and had the grades to go there, but I just wanted to stay close to her, so I ended up going. But in some ways it was quite nice because I flourished there. Ended up with a good degree, got a first in my degree, and was immediately given funding to do a PhD. And it's quite unusual doing a PhD without doing a master's, but they just gave me this funding and ended up doing a PhD in church history, and in particular in the history of Roman Catholicism in Wales in the 20th century. And then after that, just seemed to, you know, again, I always felt like I was in the right place at the right time all the time. And that's, you know, as a person of faith, that seemed to inspire me, and I just felt like I somehow was being looked down upon in some way if you're using those kind of terminology, or something was drawing me into certain places. So when we knew each other, I was in the right time in the right place, and ended up as a head of department at quite a young age, as you can probably remember. I was only 27, 28. But still, there was something, and I'm sure you remember this journey that I was on. There was something that wasn't quite right. It didn't sit right with me. That I needed to give back more. I always felt that being in higher education, certainly in the institutions I'd been in, a lot of it was just filling the lecture rooms, so funding could be brought into to the universities, which is necessary, of course, hugely necessary. But I didn't feel that was my calling. So it was always going to go in a different way, which it did in the end, of course.
No, so I knew you. That's interesting, actually, because when you said that you were planning on being ordained, in a way, I at first was surprised, because I just assumed that you were going to have this academic career. But I also wondered myself whether, although I'm privileged to have done and still doing the job that I love, but there's also a big part of me that thinks that's great, but it's not necessarily the only thing. Yeah. And maybe in a way, during the interviews as well, there's sort of like twin interests. But but I think that you've obviously found that at an earlier point, and it seems to have really defined you.
Yes.
Well, your publications, for example, are very much in the area of bringing out that pastoral dimension.
Exactly. And that was, I mean, my first book was published in 1999, and it was a version of my thesis, and so it was on church history, and I loved doing church history, and it got me to travel to a lot of places. If you probably remember, I went to, it looks like you're going to mention a few places.
I remember you went, it was India, but you did go...
Yeah, I did go to India, but I went to Sydney as well, to Sydney University to give a few lectures at Sydney University. I also went to Philadelphia, if you remember that. Yeah. Chicago,
during the real... It was really cold, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
January.
Well, interestingly, Chicago and India came immediately after each other. So I went from being absolutely freezing in the windy city to directly to the heat of India quite soon afterwards. And Philadelphia, spoke at Bryn Mawr College, which, of course, has a Welsh link, it should be pronounced Bryn Mawr College, but the Americans don't know how to speak Welsh, funnily enough. So it got me to travel, and now travel actually tires me out. So I'm pleased I did it then. But yes, I was taken in a different direction. I just felt that God was calling me to something different. And so I ended up being trained for ministry at Wycliffe in Oxford. Did a master's in Oxford University.
So you got to do the master's in the end, just in the wrong order.
I did, strangely enough. Yeah, it was like a little jigsaw piece being put into place. But also, it was a master's in applied theology. So it immediately made what I was doing relevant to what I wanted to do and what I felt called to do. So within my master's in Oxford University, I spent a year, one day a week, going to Campsfield House Deportation Centre, which is an asylum seekers deportation centre, and just working with the chaplaincy team there and seeing some things that I've never forgotten, and people in such distress being sent back to all sorts of places. And then the second year I worked in a chaplaincy, in Jesus College chaplaincy, one day a week again. And again, that really introduced me to the fact that, I suppose, we all go through all sorts of ups and downs in our lives, sometimes when we're young, sometimes when we're older. But none of us are able to escape the fact that there are sufferings in life as well as joys.
And did you find then, because obviously you did a PhD, you're doing it in church history, but did you feel that there was... that you wanted to bring the faith angle out more than you were able... I found that channeling through academic study, a lot of my passion, my interest in theology was there. Because I, in a way, had a slightly different journey to you, because I had a faith which kind of just got sublimated through the research, through studying theology. Mm-hmm. More, I think, because I felt that I could ask questions without somebody saying you're not allowed to think that.
Okay,
and I just sort of felt that if I was studying near-death experiences, so anything that... used to concern me about, you know, is there a life after death? In a way, I could do the research and say, well, go to the library, look at what people of faith or non-faith perspectives are saying on that. But in a way, that kind of fulfilled me in a way that I just always assumed that I'd be involved in the chapel, the chaplaincy when I was at university. I never did any of that, really. But you obviously had a different journey.
Yes, it was a different journey. And part of the journey, as far as my written work is concerned, was the fact that, you know, that my first book, an academic book, you know, that only 500 copies were printed, and I didn't sell those 500 copies. You know, it's in universities across the world, no one rushes out to get an academic textbook, do they? And you don't necessarily reach as many people as you hope to. And so there was this drive also that I wanted to reach people and I wanted to connect. And so all my later books, which came after being at Oxford and after having experience of sitting with people through their joys and through their times of suffering and pain, all those books then were doing their best to connect with people where they are. And not necessarily to go over their heads, but bring my academic learning into a way that I could relate. And that's why a lot of my books do deal with big themes of faith, but also big themes of life, and they do that through, for example, real life situations. And I talk about stories about my own life, or they do that through film, where I reflect on film and explore the big Christian doctrines through film, or they do that through popular music or poetry or art. So I feel then I can connect with people in a better way, and it has shown, you know, in the amount they sell more popular books, that you are connecting with more people. I think so.
Yeah, and I think that I don't want my, you know, obituary to consider people, yeah, he wrote Screen Christologies, because that is an important part of who I am. But I do a lot more. Just before we started recording, I was saying I've always kept a diary. But it's interesting because the diary is a far more personal thing. And the books, I wonder, because I guess people will see what my passions are. You know, if they look at anything I've written, at least they'll say, well, this is obviously an area that interests him. And they might want to, you know, want to ask, you know, what it is that drives me. But in a way, I feel that you've got to go somewhere else for that. But of course, I would say that the stuff that really defines me is not the stuff that I, for obvious reasons, am able to publish. So for that reason, I kind of feel there's a lot of me that maybe through, for example, comes out through these interviews.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing as well. But that need to disseminate yourself, but also disseminate the right part of yourself.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you've got the right balance.
Well, I hope so. It's strange, isn't it? Even at quite a young age, I started thinking about what is my legacy? What am I leaving in this world? What am I leaving with other people, and how am I affecting other people? I think I've always been quite an empathetic person, and that can be a negative thing, because you can be so sensitive to, am I saying something that's going to hurt this person? And it can make you sort of withdraw. But actually, it can also be a positive thing, because you're constantly thinking, okay, what am I teaching this person when I say this thing? And with your family, you're constantly sort of thinking those kind of questions.
I mean, the thing I've always found, though, is that if there's an authenticity there, if you ask questions in a particular way and that's right for you, then people will respect that. The worst thing is if you feel that you're just doing somebody else's bidding, or you're trying to, I mean, this can happen even with my students sometimes, who are always afraid sometimes if they're giving a presentation, if they're referring to something that, you know, if it's my course, it's religion and film, and they never quite know whether to bring me in or not, and they might want to quote me, but they don't know whether to call me Chris or DC, or they look at me and say, is that okay? And I'm like, look, you're not going to get, you know, be marked down because you say something that, you know, that's absurd. That goes against the ethos of education. But I can see why they would do that. And it's just interesting that sometimes you've got to find the right level. And I think if you find that, then everyone's okay with it. People know where you're coming from and what the boundaries are.
Yeah, completely. And it is about authenticity, I think. So there's a quotation I did on a film recently. You might be able to tell me which film it is. I can't remember. But it's someone said, be yourself. Be yourself because everyone else is taken. And there is that. That is true. That's all we can be is ourselves. There's no point trying to look at someone else and try and be that. All you can be is yourself. If you're a sensitive person, you're going to be sensitive. Mm. But it's being aware. So a lot of my sort of work in my later books is on awareness. Mm. And I think a lot of the great religious traditions talk about awareness. And that sort of, you know, one of the great, well, I suppose, you know, if you say, how do we differ from animals, as our species? Well, it's because we're conscious of our own consciousness. And so that in itself is a form of awareness. Mm. And if you look at all the great philosophers, you know, all the great religious teachers talk about self-awareness and being aware of who you are and what you are. And I think when you start from awareness, you can only go one way, and that is towards compassion, and that is towards hope and peace and love. And so that's always inspired me, and that is at the root of a lot of my publications of the past 10 years or so.
No, I think that's really important, because I sometimes feel that, you know, as part of my job, I have to publish, but also you think, well, who is the audience? And I guess it's generations of students who hopefully, especially, you know, obviously will buy the books that you're teaching on. But also that there are other wider questions about why we do the research we do. You know, are we doing it for its own sake? Are we doing it to advance academia, scholarship has to be enhanced by you with your contribution, or are we doing it simply because, well, I doubt we do it for money, you know, because I'm certainly waiting for that paycheck. I might get like the odd £11 paycheck, but I said not enough to retire on. So I think that's good. It sounds like you were asking those questions at a much earlier age, and I think that's important, because if you're going to invest a lot of time, and often it's not, you know, it's vocational, it's what's coming up from what you're saying is it's clearly vocational, but it's nothing to do with being paid for this, that, you know, you're doing this because there's an audience for this, and even if you're doing it for yourself, because you need to address those questions, and if it resonates with an audience out there, then all the better.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, as you know, now I'm back in higher education, I think when you're trying to juggle those elements of what being a lecturer actually involves, or a tutor involves, it involves research, it involves administration, it involves teaching. And I don't think the reality is you need all those three elements, you know? And I think the problem is often one is seen as more important than the other. And in the past, I don't know if you know more than I do about this, but in the past, research has been put on this pedestal. Yeah. And so therefore teaching has been almost pushed down. But the reality is, if you ask, as you said, what influence have you had, Chris, over the past 20, 30 years? What is your legacy? I imagine the first thing you'll do is start listing, you know, your books, your articles, the papers you've given. Yeah. But the reality is, your real legacy is your teaching, because you have influenced so many young people, and you've inspired so many young people that who themselves are now often teachers, police, or whatever they're going on to do, who are inspiring other young people, lawyers, you know. And so it's almost, you know, that the academic work we do, and even the more popular books I do, don't have as much influence, I am sure, than when I go and speak in a school, or when I speak in my church on a Sunday and get my 10-minute slots to say something worthwhile after reflecting on scripture.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, because there was a time, certainly people who started in the 1970s, and some of them who have now retired, but I've interviewed some of them, they'd say that when they were appointed, nobody ever talked about research. It was more a case of, well, do it in your spare time, but, you know, enhance the quality of, you know, the life in the university, the student experience, then that was something that was sort of expected. Then research became big, and some of those same people felt a bit sidelined. But now some of those people who always said the important thing is publish or perish, then found that it's grant applications. And of course now the big word is impact. Yeah. So now it's almost gone full circle. You need to publish, but you need to publish in a way that people are actually using or can use. So often it's getting grant applications to go and interview people, study people, spend time in different communities, actually make an impact. Get on the radio, do something where there's a direct correlation between you doing the work, which may or may not take place in an office on your own, and the dissemination of that. And it's funny to almost sit back and see all of those things happen. Different generations of academics who have a different take of what is the most important thing in that profession. And I've witnessed it all.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, it raises that question, why would we be in this profession? And that, I think, is something I'm going through at the moment. Because, you know, if 20 years ago you'd said to me, you know, going around interviewing people, I'd say, yeah, but it has to have a clear publication, but which would mean a book publication outlet, then you know, that would just sort of be seem to be de rigueur. But these days, of course, if you're doing something that has wider impact, then that in itself is it's hugely important, because it shows that the research has a point, has a telos, has a goal.
So would I'm asking you a question now, Chris. I'm becoming the interviewer. Sort of study guide, when I was, you know, heavily involved in academia 20 years ago, you know, a book that was a study guide or an introduction was not seen as important. And I always thought that was a real failing of the system. Yeah. Because if you can express complex ideas in a way that is able to reach as many people as possible, surely that's a real gift, and surely that's part of what academia should be about.
I think you're right. And what happened in one case is that I wrote a book for Blackwell, who were only interested really in the textbook market because they could see the need for it, exactly as you just outlined. But then they wanted, in order to make sure that their constituency was then aware of this book, on the back cover, and I wasn't aware of this, they said something like, you know, in this important textbook, Christopher DC, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh no, because then I had to go to my colleagues to say, this is one of my submissions for the REF, or the RAE, as it used to be called then. Yeah. And I remember the first thing somebody, it was counted, they were fine with it. But one of the first things that was picked out was, oh, it says textbook on the back, that's going to count against you.
Oh.
And
that's, I suppose that's what drove me to want to write books, not just introductions to things which I'd like to do in the future, but just books and articles that can really connect with people, and not just people who are able to grasp, you know, hugely complex ideas in hugely complex ways of saying those ideas, but everybody. There's no reason Christian theology can't be accessible. There's no reason it can't, you know, reach out to people and change people's lives.
But the important thing is the order in which it's done, because having done the degree and the PhD, you've got, if you like, the structures in place.
Yeah, exactly.
And often I find it with my teaching is that somebody does as a wild module, my religion and film course, but because they haven't got that same scaffolding, they struggle a bit, because they then think, oh, it's not really about my favourite film. Or they might think, but they come from a position of faith in some cases. Yeah. They think, oh, well, this will be an easy module to pass. Then they realise there are different methodologies and conceptual frameworks that other students might have done through other modules where they had to learn the basics.
Yeah.
So I think that that's the right way to do it. So in a way, you have the expertise, but then what you do with it, how you disseminate that, is something that can be a bit more bespoke.
Exactly. And I think that's there's no doubt in my mind that the journey I've been on through my academic life, but also just generally through life, had to take place in that order. I needed to get my PhD. I needed to do, you know, 6, 7, 8 years of teaching at a higher education level, eventually as a senior lecturer, before I could then almost shed it all and say, right, I'm now going to use that expertise to reach out to as many people as possible in an engaging way as possible. So I completely agree with that.
And some more philosophically based questions, shall we say. Would you say that your memories, Tristan, are predominantly positive ones?
Yes. I'm very good at just looking back and remembering the good things in life. And I often, you know, it's the more painful memories that are almost blocked out in some way, and I don't really revisit them, and I have to force myself to, no, I've got to recognise that time in my life wasn't all great. Because generally, I my memories are quite optimistic, and so that's why I'm particularly interested in your podcast as nostalgia. It's something I'm quite interested in, the idea of nostalgia, the idea of looking back in time and thinking, wasn't that era great? Because there's something about it that is true, because every era has something that was great about it.
Do you have a particular sort of year, or is there a particular era from your life where everything seemed to fall into place? Well, do you know why that was?
I think for me, when I look back to my childhood, 70s and 80s, I think what a great era that was. But I mean, one of my favourite albums came from just before that. It's one of the Kinks albums, Village Green Preservation Society. And that's all about nostalgia. But of course, they're looking back, that was in the late 60s, they're looking back at the 40s and 50s and seeing those as a great era where everyone was. And he even lists, Ray Davis lists in that album, all sorts of things that he misses, you know. And he talks about Desperate Dan and China cups, and English tea, and the village green, fresh air, Sunday school. And he says, and all that's gone. And I think, and in one of the songs on that album, Do You Remember Walter, he meets a friend from school called Walter, and during that song he comes to a realization: Walter's changed, everything has changed. But that needn't be a bad thing, that everything's changed, as long as we don't throw out the memories. So I think it's good to keep hold of the memories. Nostalgia is an important thing, but use those memories to inspire the present, I think. And yeah, often we don't. We use those memories to want to go back.
Yeah.
We want to go back to the era when, you know, Britain was great, or, you know, it sort of is that kind of idea. Yeah. But
no, I think the way it's been used politically, and as part of the work I'm doing on this, I remember coming across both Vince Cable talking about nostalgia in a way of, you know, Brexit, and sort of, you know, for Britain that may no longer or may never have existed, except in people's imaginations. And Gordon Brown also spoke about nostalgia in the sense that he thinks it's a dangerous thing to do, because it's that whole sort of looking back as a time that was better. And he said, but really, you need to be forward-looking. But I think you can have both, because maybe it's keeping a diary that has helped this, that I can keep a check on whether my memories are distorted. It can happen on a superficial level with a film, and you think, oh, I remember really enjoying that film. The diary says, oh, it was a load of rubbish. And I think, ah. But other times when it does chime, that you sometimes think, that was a really good, you know, occasion in my life. Why was it? And I think of birthday of parties or something where everybody comes together. Mm. People that you see, but they've never all met each other. The people, you know, we all meet people in different capacities, and suddenly they're all there in the same room at the same time. So, like, all the important people who've never met each other. And, you know, I remember once thinking a particular birthday, there's a photograph which I often share on social media, and I look back on the diary entry for that day and I say in capital letters, you know, this was a brilliant day. And I think that's it. So even at the time I knew there was something special about it.
Yeah, and there's something about, you know, the reality is we all look back at our childhood at a certain era, not always our childhood, it could be in our 20s or whatever, and see that as, oh, that was a good era. But the reality is, once we're here now, especially as older people, the fact that we haven't seen each other for 15 years, we're very different people, we've grown in a different way. And now, in my mind, is not just look back at that era and sort of, you know, and just wallow in that era, but look back in that era, be uplifted by that era to make this era an era that our children and our grandchildren can then look back at and themselves say, wasn't 2019 a great year?
And I can actually see that, because I went through a period for, you know, personal circumstances where I kind of thought I had to go back.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of the Back to the Future in it, the idea of almost going back and finding the point of the origin point, or, you know, where it all went wrong. And there's something almost like prelapsarian, you know, go back to the golden age and stop the rot from happening. But there's also part of me that thinks, but this is another way of looking at it. Why a particular, I think of like my second year at university particularly, something fell into place. I was writing essays all the time. I was getting some good marks. But I also had the most amazing network of friends. I'd go and play, I never played pool well, but I'd go just stand around the pool table, have a few drinks. But that camaraderie, there was something in that which, you know, I was unbelievably busy, but also had a, you know, was also busy socially. So academic and socially, everything came together. And I think, I feel I'm in that sort of mindset now in a way that I wasn't for many years, that I might have one but not the other. And I think it's that sense of balance, that equilibrium. So nostalgia can be about saying, not just I want to go back and relive 1992 again, go back in a time machine and relive it. It can be a case of saying there was something that happened around that time where I felt I could flourish. And if I can flourish again, then that's, you know, it's almost as though that's almost where the, not the medicine, what I mean, but the prescription lies. And that's where almost like I know that if I can in some way inhabit that same sort of mindset, then I've kind of got the building blocks in place.
Exactly. And the idea of what makes something great, what is being great? And I think that needs to be explored by our country and other countries as well. And the idea, you know, when we say, you know, I want Britain to be great again, but my definition of great is more loving, more compassionate, more welcoming, more more empathetic, rather than great being, I don't know, you know, I could look at, for example, my I've just mentioned a few minutes ago that my wife is from Germany originally, and she tells me about her grandfather, who was in the 1930s, was one of the very few people in his little village who actively opposed the Third Reich and got into huge trouble. He was told by all his friends and by a lot of his own family that, you know, they wanted to make Germany great again. And he would answer, well, I want to make Germany great again as well. But Germany being great for me is for it to become a more loving place, a place of welcome and compassion. Making Germany great for them was making it into a better military power, or make it, its economy thrive. And we need to ask this question: what do we even mean when we want to make something great?
And it works in education as well, in the sense that when I was at school, it always felt that the important thing was conformity and discipline. That, you know, you have to say the right thing and behave and become a good citizen. It's only a little bit. Last week we talked about the 11 plus earlier. It was only a little bit later. I started to think, well, of course, you need to pass exams, you need to, you know, get to know the content of what you're studying and thrive and really get, you know, and of course, hence great research, obviously, in later years was born. But that's interesting that, you know, at the age of 11 or 12, I don't think anybody said, you know, this is why you're in school. It's more a case of you have to be in school, and if you don't conform, you'll be in trouble. And I don't know if anybody ever gave me, it was a wonderful school and I thrived there. But at that age, maybe I didn't feel that I quite knew, or nobody had given me the narrative that in later years I take and I share with my own students. Yeah. But I didn't have it myself at that age.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that the education policy of a country should be first on any list, because I think what you teach your children actually reflects the values of a country, it reflects the values of the people of a country. And increasingly in Britain, what we're seeing is that entrepreneurial skills is becoming very, very important, even at primary school. You know, my son's just 5, and he's already had a whole term on what money is. Yeah. Of course he has to understand what money is, but it's almost he's almost become obsessed with money because of it. And I remember speaking to my 18-year-old, he was probably 16 at the time, and he was telling me about all these lessons he was having about the economy and entrepreneurial skills. And I said, have you had any lessons on the climate and climate change? And he said, I think we did have one 3 or 4 years back. And it's almost as if it's not the teacher's fault, because they're being given a curriculum that they need to impart in that way. And perhaps it's just, you know, we need to look at that again and bring these, you know, a different way of thinking about education.
Yeah, and the trouble with a curriculum sometimes is that it can, for that reason, be a little bit too limiting. When you think of An Inconvenient Truth, you know, the Al Gore documentary some years ago, I think there was a parent in Kent, actually, funny enough, who'd said, in the county, not the university, who didn't agree with the Gore's message, and you know, didn't see climate change as being the problem that it was, and then said this is not education, it's propaganda. But again, see, this is the thing about mindset and what it is that, you know, what it, you know, and of course in America with intelligent design and, you know, creation and evolution. And I think that some of those debates need to be properly discussed, you know, almost the philosophy of education. You know, you know, rather than say this should or shouldn't be on the curriculum, there needs to be a wider sense of, well, actually, what is the curriculum for?
Yeah, and there are certain attitudes, values that will go over the whole curriculum. And we did a lot of this 20 years ago when we were working together, didn't we? I mean, I remember part of the push at the time, and I've got no idea if it still is, but there was a subject called SMSC. Do you remember being involved in that? And we taught teachers spiritual, moral, social and cultural development. Yeah. And we taught them to see that across the whole of their subjects. So even if they were teaching maths or geography, they had to think, well, what's the social implication of that? What's the spiritual? What's the moral? And what's the cultural? And we did things like we took ant farms out to schools and we just put an ant on a 5-year-old's hands and just saw his eyes open up, and as if this was an amazing, there was something, you know, spiritual about that moment for me. And I don't think that's lost. I think that probably still happens. But I think once you get down to the nitty-gritty of teaching subjects, in schools and the expectations to get certain grades, and the expectations often we ourselves are to blame for that as parents, because, you know, I want my kids to get great grades, you know, and so we forget that actually that isn't the most important thing, because the reality is, yes, I want my kids to get great grades, but if you said to me, what would you prefer your kids to get, great grades or be rounded human beings that will contribute to society in a, in a compassionate and uplifting way, I would without doubt choose the second option.
And I think you're right, because the danger sometimes, and it even happens with students doing degrees, that they do a module not because they necessarily want to change the world, but it's for credit, and that they, you know, for whatever reason they're doing a particular degree program and they choose that module. So I'm often teaching death and the afterlife and aware that, you know, I never quite know how people are responding to this. You know, it's touching on some personal topics, but some students I'm quite sure are just able to say, well, I'm doing this to write an essay, I'll do that essay, then the other essay, do the exam, and I'm done, rather than necessarily reflect. And that's fine, but it's just that for some other students, okay, we will almost say they forget that they're doing a degree sometimes because they get so absorbed in the subject that it's the process, it's the journey there rather than the end goal. But at the end of the day, it is, of course, it's about getting a good degree, getting that 2-1 or a first or whatever they're able to aim for in order to move on to the next stage in their journey and get a good job.
Yeah, and it's a recognition, of course, that it's great how you put that, really, because it's a recognition that the journey is as important as the destination. But that doesn't mean the destination is not important, but the journey is as important. I think a lot of times today we think it's all about getting somewhere. It's all about competing. It's all about being better than another person, rather than recognising, yes, getting there is important, but actually the actual process of doing things, whether it's through education, whether it's through life, whether it's through bringing up a family, the actual journey is as important as the destination.
And I think sometimes we forget that as soon as we reach one particular goal or we reach that destination, then there's another destination. You know, you get
exactly.
You don't then say, "Oh, I've made it. I've achieved all there is. There's nothing more for me to do." You just move on to the next, whether it's educational or otherwise. And life is full of those, often in tandem. You know, that you have an educational goal, but you might be looking after a sick relative, or you might have a personal, you know, sporting competition. You might want to be, you know, king of the badminton world or something. You know, and you're doing that as well as an academic achievement. So, you know, there are lots of goals, and sometimes, of course, you're at university ostensibly to get a degree, but there might be 5 or 6 other answers that are equally pressing at different periods.
Completely, and as you grow, you realise this more and more. Because when you're younger, you only have a few things that you actually are thinking about are important. Of course, there are people that do have other things to juggle. But when I was younger, you know, I needed to just go to university or school, whenever it was, and just pass my grades, you know, and just enjoy going along with this, perhaps do a bit of work in the sense of I was going to say real work then, but you know, but as in, you know, I used to work in Woolworths, I worked in Asda, I worked in Burger King, which is interesting. That's probably why I became vegetarian, to tell you the truth. But I worked in a pub, I had a paper round, so I did that kind of work as well, and that was on my mind. But that was it as a young person.
No, I didn't do any of that. I went to university and kind of feel that's when I grew up. I started living at the age of 18. My students now have jobs. Right, and I'm in awe of them, really, because they're doing a lot of them. Of course, sometimes if they don't come to lectures, it's not because they're lazy, it's because they have a job, and often that job is what's paying for them to do their degree.
Exactly. But I think when you grow, other things come into your life, and for me, you know, now I'm in my mid-40s, yes, I have to be thinking about my ministry, my work. I have to be thinking about what I'm going to publish next. I have to be thinking about my lectures that I'm teaching on, but I also have to be thinking about my family now as well, and that has to be a priority, because again, you know, the one influence you do have every single day, you know, if you've got a wife or husband or partner or children, you know, you're having a huge influence on them. I also have to be thinking about juggling, as you know, Chris, I've been suffering from chronic pain for about 15 years now, so I have to be thinking about how do I manage my pain as well. It's a back condition I've got, but I think when you're in a pastoral role like I'm in, you realise there are a lot of people by the time they're our age and older that are dealing with all sorts of things and juggling all sorts of things, and so priorities have to be sort of worked out in that way.
I asked you earlier what you think your 5 or your 15-year-old self might think about what you're doing now. That whole question about whether you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young, if you had dreams. Maybe you're yeah. still waiting for those dreams to be realised.
It's interesting. We found all my old school books a few years back, and I went through them, and at 5 years old, I was going to be an explorer, and I had this big thing about where I was going in the world and so on. Never really got into that. At 10 years old, I wanted to be a police officer, and I was obsessed with being a police officer. Never became. Then I wanted to be a newsreader. Mm. So you just, you know, even the dreams you have develop very quickly because they're not the dreams then that you have 5 years later. Yeah. Having said that, you know, if someone had told me I would have, you know, at the age I was, you know, right up to 21, 22, if someone had told me you'd end up writing books, I would have been thrilled, and I would have, you know, I remember that, you probably remember it yourself, the first time I held one of my books in my hand with my name on it. It was just something surreal about it. But now I think I'm on my 6th or 7th book, and it's becoming, but you know, I could take that for granted, but I keep having to remind myself that, you know, a 5-year-old Tristan, or certainly a 10-year-old Tristan, would have looked forward and thought, oh wow, that's really special, you know. And you know, I've got three lovely children, so it's that's wonderful as well. So I think I would have been quite happy with what I'm doing. You can always, I think, with the kind of personality that I've got, you know, I always think I could be doing more. I could be doing more for people that you know, I could give out more. I could be, you know, in the context of ministry, visiting more, being there for people more. But you only have so much energy to give, and so much, you know, when it comes down to it, so much love and compassion to give. You know, there is only so much you can do. And you have to accept that. Otherwise, you will burn out. And that's been a journey that I've had to realise as well.
No, and I think knowing your limits, knowing your boundaries, and that can be positive as well as negative. Because sometimes, you know, if you say, right, I'm going to change the world, if I'm going to be king of the world by the age of 25, and you're not, then, you know, you need to change your goals.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So,
what about, just two more questions. Are you in touch with friends from your past? Although, I know we fell out of touch for about 15 years, and now we're back in. So, but, you know, other than that.
We won't do it from now on, will we, Chris? We won't do from now on. Yes, not massively. I mean, Facebook has helped hugely. I remember when Friends Reunited came out, that immediately helped. And then, of course, Facebook came and you connect with people. But there are certain people that I've kept in touch with for years and years. I've got a very good friend up in North Wales who I was his best man. And he was diagnosed as going blind when he was about 12 or 13, and I was one of his closest friends at the time. So we went through that together. You know, I stood alongside him with that. He stood alongside me through lots of ups and downs, especially in my 20s. I had all sorts of stuff happening then. And then a year or so ago, or less than a year, his wife suddenly passed away. Suddenly, no sign, just died. And we'd sort of seen each other every couple of years up to 6 months ago. And we've really, because I think that's what it is. As soon as we need each other, we're there for each other. You know, and I've been up and we've reconnected. He's been down here to Cardiff to visit, you know, which I always, you know, I'm in complete awe of him, how as a person who, you know, has a white stick, is able to still travel all the way down here and get himself to my house. It's just wonderful how he does it. And we just connect beautifully. So I have that. I have a friend who I was very good friends with in the sixth form, who happens to be in down the road from Cardiff in Penarth. Very good friends with him. So I there are people that I, you know, that I know I can go to at any point that you can connect with. And it's, you know, just the old friendship reignites in that way. So yeah, certainly, but it is hard. It is hard once you move on to somewhere else to keep in touch with everybody in the same way and the same level of friendship.
No, and especially if you've known people at different periods of your life.
Yeah.
And in some cases, and you find that on Facebook as well, that some people are academic friends, some people are school friends, some people are family members, some people are friends because you've connected with them because they work in the cafe down the road.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And in a way, any post you put up is going to be seen very differently. Some people might say, too academic, not academic enough, too trivial, or too wordy, or too picture-based. You know, everyone's going to have a different take on that. But that's life. We all, you know, we are responsible in many cases for the friendships we have and how we cultivate them. And so sometimes, but we are the common link. So whatever we put out is going to be seen differently by different people. But hopefully enough people will be able to say, yeah, I want to I want to read that. I want to follow that through because you want that friendship to be maintained virtually, if not physically.
Exactly. And I'm not one for posting much on Facebook, I must admit. It's not. It's just not in my personality to do that. But I do value Facebook as a way of being able to at least keep in touch with people, even if it's just a little message. And you know, we wouldn't be, you know, reconnecting as we've done if it wasn't for Facebook, because that's how we really sort of connected again. Maybe we would have had one email and that would have been it. So I do value it, even though, and we won't look into this, but I'm sure we haven't got time to look into the dangers of Facebook and the problems inherent in social media, which are vast in all sorts of ways. And, you know, I see that with my teenage kids. You know, I have huge worries about what social media is doing to young people at the moment. But you know, it also has positives, and you just have to accept that. And
no, you're right, because when I was very young, I'd always go around with the radio, and I'd be obsessed with what was on the radio at the time. These days, children and adults, where I'm no different from my 7-year-old self, all go around with a phone in the same way. And you're, but the difference, of course, you're interacting with other people, or people's avatars anyway. You're interacting with the versions of themselves that they put out on social media.
And
as you say, there are all sorts of dangers with that.
Completely. And to me, it's even, you know, there was a report recently that that YouTube is one of those platforms that has far more positives than perhaps some of the social media ones that lead to bullying and so on. But I have huge questions about YouTube as well. I have huge questions that of something that you watch little clips, you get dragged into it, and then it gives you all these similar clips, which then drags you into watching all sorts of other stuff. And and I just think that there are problems inherent in all, you know, social media platforms, in all apps in that way, including in computer games. I'm not a massive computer gamer, but my youngest brother is. And just having him visit last week, he was telling me about the latest thing in computer games, where, you know, you play the computer game and then you have to pay to buy coins to sort of, well, as you've mentioned the word avatars there, to update your avatar. And young people, he's a teacher, and he's saying young people just, that's what they spend their money on these days. And it's not a case of, like, when I was younger, you bought Repton. Do you remember Repton on the BBC Micro?
Oh, well, I certainly remember going to HMV and Woolworths. Maybe you were certainly once, and bought the latest chart record. But no,
Repton was a computer game. Yeah. But there was all sorts. You could, you know, Jet Set Willy was another one. Oh. You know, or Chucky Egg was another one. But you bought it, and that was it. Yeah. You bought it, and you play that game. Well, these days, you buy something, and then there are costs inherent within that. So a lot of it, the newest football games, so I'm told by my brother, you collect your fantasy football team by purchasing stuff online to see if you can get the better players. So it's almost capitalism gone mad, to tell you the truth. And it's not just a case of selling a game now, it's selling a game and then selling things within the game. And I just have huge questions about those kind of don't really want to start to finish on such a negative thing, Chris. Well, so ask me a question as well.
Well, my very last question is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I can definitely finish that one in a very, very positive sense, in the sense that I consider myself a hugely hopeful person. You know, and why do I consider myself a hugely hopeful person? It's because of my faith. You know, there's no doubts in me, because otherwise I would be pretty depressed looking at the world as it is at the moment, looking at the country as it is at the moment. You know, I've got a real heart for the environment, a real heart for welcome and compassion, as you've probably heard through this interview. And I look at Britain and I look at the world, and we're not doing great at any of those things at the moment. But I believe in the inherent, you know, goodness of humanity, that we can, you know, there's something that I do believe that we have to keep hold of, that hope that the future has to be, you know, has to be bright in some ways. And, you know, all civilizations go through ups and downs, and, you know, maybe we're in a bit of a dip at the moment, but, you know, just as we'll be cast down, we'll rise again, as the theologian Boethius talked about life as a wheel. And yes, you can be at the top of the world on a wheel, but you'll soon be cast down. But you can also be right down the bottom of a wheel, but very soon you're back at the top again. And that is true. You know, it's true of individual lives. If I'm going through a difficult time myself, I remember that and think, yeah, things will get better. I just need to hold on to that fact. But I think that's true of society as well. And I think it's true of the world. So I'm a hopeful person, despite being very... sad about a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing in the world at the moment.
No, well, that was a hopeful note, but bittersweet is a word that well, so we could have considered there. But well, we mustn't make it 15 years before we catch up again. Tristan, it's been definitely so wonderful to catch up with you this afternoon.
Thank you, Chris.